You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Carcy-Baev.
I'm Martha Heller, CEO of Heller Search Associates.
Awesome. Martha, thanks so much for finding time to be with us on the Ivy Podcast today. Just a little background story on how this episode actually came about. I've read your book, the Be the Business, the CIO, and I was so inspired by it. It's been a couple of years since I've read it, and I constantly revisit that because mainly I come from a corporate side, being in technology myself most of my career, and a lot of the lessons that you had mentioned in the book resonated so well with me. So that's what motivated me and inspired to kind of reach out and get you on the podcast. And I'm excited about this conversation that, some of the things we're going to talk about is what you've covered in the actual book. So I'm super pumped.
Well, thank you, John. I'm glad to hear it. I hope this isn't terribly disappointing for you. We'll find out.
No, it's great. I'm super excited. Martha, tell us a little bit more about your background. Where do you come from? And how did your current, company form? What was the motivation behind it? Curious to hear that story.
Sure. So I actually started out in journalism. My plan was to go be a reporter or something like that. And I moved to New York City. And the first job I got was at Local Area Network Magazine, LAN Magazine. I'm dating myself, right? And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the writing about technology, learning about technology in all these different contexts. It was less about the technology itself, and it was more about how businesses were applying the technology was a particular interest. And then from there, I left New York and I went out to San Francisco for a while. I got a temp job at an executive search firm, and I enjoyed the work, and I kind of just shelved that as a potential career. And then I went to graduate school to get a PhD in English literature, decided academia wasn't for me. So I made my way to the Boston area and I joined CIO Magazine. And I was at CIO Magazine for many years. I wrote an online column for them, early days for the internet. And I started a group called the CIO Executive Council, a professional organization of CIOs. And that is continues today. The great thing about being a founder of something is you can leave it, but you're still always a founder. So that I was happy about that. And then I decided for a number of reasons to revisit that interest in executive search that I had developed earlier in my career. And I left CIO Magazine and I joined a firm called ZRG Partners, a boutique firm where they were really innovating in executive search. And I learned all about executive search, and I built the CIO practice there. That quickly became the biggest practice. I was the big biller. And so after 5 years with ZRG, several people had said to me, you are tailor-made to do your own boutique firm. I come from a long line of entrepreneurs, and so decided now's the time. My wonderful father gave me $50,000 to start my new business. And back in 2010, we started Heller Search, and we've been growing ever since then. And I'll just say one other thing, John, which is that critical to all of this has been my relationship with CIO Magazine. After I left the publication formally and was at ZRG, I reached out and said, hey, I could be an outside contributor. I'd still love to contribute to the magazine. And they were very open to that. And so I've had a column in CIO Magazine and now online really for, since 1999 now. So that's a long time of communicating in writing to the CIO audience. And of course, that's been very important to our work here today.
Right. That's a lot of content.
That's right. It is. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you for sharing your story. It sounds, very interesting, very unique. And, Boston is very dear to my heart. I have spent some couple of years there myself. And speaking of, the Boston and kind of what you do, just a little bit story from my standpoint, when I was at Harvard, one of the professors, guest lecturers, Fernando Araoz, he's also in a similar space as you're in executive search. And one of the books that he had recommended, which also had a profound impact on me professionally is, it's not the who, it's not the what or the why, it's all about the who. And the book really, you know, has very similarities in with what you covered in your book. But my key takeaway from that, which actually motivated me to, you know, to start the Ivy podcast, is it's a contact sport. It's all relationship based. It's, you know, at the end of the day, it's more, you know, of course, it matters what you know, but also what gets you in the door is also who you know. And building and cultivating those relationships, I think it's, you know, for me, it's been a great lesson and a takeaway.
Super excited
to hear that. And from your standpoint, as you operate in kind of the executive search, CTOs and CIOs, what role of kind of the relationships with these CIOs and other executives play in your, you know, in the success of your company? How, you know, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I mean, you know, relationships are everything, you know, in almost any role that you can be in. So for executive search, you know, the relationships matter, but I think as much as that, it's subject matter expertise. You know, a data warehouse is not the same thing as a data lake. And if you don't understand that, you're going to be going after the wrong candidates.
Right.
So I think subject matter is expertise is important. Where relationships matter is, yes, the relationship between individual recruiters and the candidates they work with, of course, is important because you're trying to get somebody to change their lives. You're trying to get somebody to change their compensation, to potentially move their family. So having that relationship and the trust and the credibility is all very important. But for Heller Search, I think what's been more important than individual relationships is our brand credibility. Is that when Heller Search calls a potential candidate, they've heard of us, they respect us, they know that we've been engaged in thought leadership, they feel that we've had some impact on their careers if they've read any of our work. And so the brand credibility is important, you know, really sought after CIOs or CTOs, they get a million calls and they got to make choices about which calls they answer. And I feel that they answer our calls because of individual relationships with our teams, but even more than that, because they feel a relationship with the brand, because the brand has been putting out thought leadership precisely for the CIO role since the late 90s. So that's where I think, you know, I think the relationship comes in. But, you know, it's interesting. Prior to this conversation with you this morning, I was talking to a candidate. This was a candidate for a CIO position. And my client loves everything about him. He's got the technical expertise, transformational leadership, you know, business process knowledge, all team leadership. The one thing they didn't get from him was a sense of warmth and heart and the kind of spirit that's important to them in their culture. In another culture, they might not have cared about that. It might have been about different things. Mm-hmm. So when I prepped him this morning, I said, you've got to sort of dig deep and bring all of your warmth to the fore, because when you lead technology, something will go wrong with technology. That's, you can't innovate and expect nothing ever to go wrong. And what allows business to continue and allows everybody to get over those technology challenges, it is the relationships. So yes, relationships are important to executive search, but when we assess candidates for any of our senior roles, their ability to build relationships is one of the key criteria that we're looking for.
Right, absolutely. I love that example. And that leads me to kind of further question that I wanted to ask you about is kind of that modern CIO with the current times and, you know, with the pandemic, the shift to different dynamics of operating. And
yes,
kind of something that you've mentioned in your response that resonates well with me. I've worked for many, you know, very great CIOs and inspirational leaders. And something that really stood out is, you know, building that culture where, you know, we're not necessarily reactive to problems, but we actually welcome those, you know, problems as more of opportunities that, okay, we're not just completely reacting, something went wrong, but instead it's the culture of something always will go wrong. And it's your ability to actually flip that into an opportunity and work together. And I think what I've seen in really great leadership from the CIO perspective is really to build that atmosphere, build that culture. So some of the examples you're giving is, you know, spot on. Mm. But going back to my question, as far as the modern CIO with the current times, What do companies currently look for or need in a CIO in today's market conditions? What have you seen kind of evolve as part of the latest trends?
You know, I guess the first thing that I'll say is none of what I'm going to say is different post-pandemic or whatever we're in now than the before times, as they say. It's all been accelerated. So, you know, data analytics, right? Having the information we need to pivot our businesses has never been more important because, as you know, so many businesses have to pivot right now. That's important. Now, supporting a remote workforce, that's more important now than it has been. At the same time, we're kind of over that hump now, right? Everybody's got the remote environments that they're going to have probably for the duration. Right. And I would also say accelerating a digital agenda. You know, if we used to feel that selling our products required some kind of handshake or a visit, well, we can't do that anymore. And so how do we convert the way we've sold our products or delivered our products to a digital model? That's going to be very important. But what I would say in any time, the CIO role is about transformation. And I just want to break that down because transformation happens in so many ways. First, there's the business transformation. I mean, I just did an interview with a candidate for a potential role where he had come in and his business was a manufacturing business. And what they've decided they needed to do was provide a fuller suite of marketing services for their clients. Well, that's a change in everything. That's different sales. That's setting up an e-commerce site. That's new partners. It's a new CRM. So business transformation, becoming, say, a digital business or an information business or a data business when we used to be an electronics manufacturer. Just think about an electronics company where what they've always done is electrical engineering to create electronics products and, you know, sell them to the market and deliver them. Well, now those companies are starting to put sensors into their electronics products, data. Well, what's the point of that data? We're putting the sensors in. What are we going to do with that data? Is that data going to become value added for our client, our customers, so that they can maybe get information about their use of those products or something? Is it going to be a new revenue stream? How do we sell that revenue stream? So the business transformation is, it's one thing to say, hey, we're going to put sensors in our products. Yeah, but what's the business model that you're now evolving, you know, that's going to make use of all of that? So that business transformation, even though the CIO is, you know, the technology leader, they're an executive of the company and they need to be involved in business transformation. So that's one. You could also call that digital transformation, right? Let's put artificial intelligence into our processes, all of that. That's one. Then there's just good old business process change technology implementation. That's transformational. My firm just placed a CIO whose job is to implement a brand new instance of SAP, an ERP, across 140 countries.
Wow.
Replacing customized homegrown technologies that allow each of those country leaders to do things in their own way. Well, we're not just implementing technology. We want to become a big global company. That means we need to standardize on the way that we do everything if this technology that we're going to put in is going to have any return on that investment. That's a big transformation. That's getting everybody, that's getting, you know, 60,000 people to row the boat in the same direction when they haven't been. That's a transformation. I'm just going to give you a couple more.
Yep.
Another is just technology transformation, right? The stack. We're moving to a cloud-first architecture. We're dismantling monolithic applications into microservices. We're creating an API-based architecture. We're creating data as a platform so that everybody in the business has access to this data. That's not business process transformation, and it's not business transformation, it's actually architectural transformation. And then there's the last one, which is culture. Yeah. Changing the culture of the IT organization so that we're engaged with the business, changing the culture of the company so that it's operating in a more digital way. Mm-hmm. So every company will have their own version of those transformations and which one is on top, but transformational leadership is the number one skill. And it goes back to what you and I were talking about relationships.
Right.
You can't be transformational if you don't really get to know the key people who are going to be helping you to drive the transformation.
Right, right, absolutely. No, I love that example. I love that point as far as transformation. And like you said, it's, you know, it's not just single direction when it comes to transformation. It's a multifaceted approach, you know, people transformation, technology, business transformation. And, you know, those have to go hand in hand. You can't just transform one little aspect of, you know, your organization and expect that everything else will follow. So
That's right. Technology is business and business is technology. It's very hard to separate them now. And in order to take a company that has always separated them and try to create a more blended technology business capability, that in itself is a transformation. That in itself is big.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I would imagine that takes a very, very unique skill set to be able to bring it all together and to command a lot of that together and really, you know, get the message across that this is the vision, this is what we're going after, and get the buy-in from everybody else. I think it's very unique. Right.
It is. So on the one hand, it's vision and buy-in, and that's all the people stuff, the communication stuff. But then way on the other hand, it's understanding architecturally and technically your environment well enough to know that if you bring a new vendor product in, what's the impact going to be? So I can't think of another role that is as broad in what it requires of its leader, because you could say, oh, a CEO, well, that's a tough role. You got to know something about finance and this and, you know, sales and customers and operations and all of that. Yeah, but you don't really have to go super deep on anything.
Right.
You've got an executive committee who goes deep. The CIO needs to be that broad, but also be able to dive very deep into tech.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that comparison. When we talk about, you know, different ideas and trends, obviously you've been in this space for a very long time. So I'm sure you research a lot. You stay on top of a lot of the trends and ideas. So when it comes to executive search, what are you currently observing, researching? What ideas and trends that excite you the most that perhaps you're looking to invest or, you know, implement as part of your organization?
So, you know, for us, what's most exciting to me in terms of what we're working on is data and transparency and collaboration. So, you know, the old way of doing executive search is you get the criteria and you go call a bunch of people and you put a slate of candidates together, maybe it takes 6-8 weeks, and then you show up hoping that you were barking up the right tree. But you never had a chance to really check in and say, hey, here's a couple of candidates we're considering. What do you think? Because it's a two-way street. We know enough about the market to know who's qualified. But if you're our client, you know about your culture. You know about when there's a crisis, how do people react? When there is a celebration, what does that look like? Are the doors open? Are the doors closed? That cultural fit is so important. We ask a lot of questions about culture, but it's got to be a partnership. It's got to be a two-way street. We can bring candidates to your door. Getting the culture as best as we can, getting that cultural fit, but it's up to our clients to then interview the candidates and give us the feedback about who's a hit and who's a miss, so that as we continue to recruit, we can take that feedback into our mind. So the things that I'm excited about with executive search, or at least where we're going with it, is one, we do something we call agile recruiting. So you might be familiar, John, with the concept of agile development. Yep. Waterfall development is we take the requirements and then we take 6 months to build the product and we hope the requirements haven't changed and that we've gotten it right.
Right.
With agile development, it's iterative meetings very often to say, we built a little bit of it. What do you think? Oh, good. Thanks for the feedback. Now we built a little bit more. And by the way, you can even start using this while we're continuing to build. So we're going to deliver a little value along the way too. That's the approach we take with executive search. So what we like to do is to go off with the requirements, 2 weeks, come back, couple of candidates. Let's have a conversation. Maybe you even want to interview these folks so that we've got that feedback in mind. It allows a little, it's more interaction with our client, which takes more of their time, but we get to that happy result much more quickly. Regarding data, we're now providing a lot of data with our executive search reports. Who's passing on this opportunity because the compensation isn't high enough? Who's passing on this opportunity because of the location? Who's passing on this opportunity because they don't like the way it's structured? our ability, sometimes you have to influence a client to say, hey, you want this candidate, but you're not paying enough. Or you want such a unique skill set that if you let this person work remotely, as opposed to having them relocate, you could be successful in this hire. The ability to provide all that data allows our clients to understand the receptivity of their position in the market and allows them to make any adjustments they need to in order to be successful. And then finally, the transparency and collaboration. We're now using a search management platform that our clients log right into. We don't email resumes, we don't do anything like that anymore. So now anytime a client is thinking, what's happening with my search? They can log right in, see who we're talking to, see the notes, see the resumes, and it creates a more collaborative relationship, which the best search projects have that. So those are just some of the areas we're innovating in that we're pretty excited about.
I love that. I love those examples. I love those trends and ideas, you know, starting with the culture and utilizing, you know, data and transparency to give, you know, the hiring organization insight into everything that you guys go through, because it's not as simple as, you know, let me just put a search out there and throw resumes your way and, you know, my job is done. It's, you know, it's a multifaceted approach. And I love what you're saying, utilizing kind of agile and scrum approach to actual, you know, search process, which is, I'm pretty sure a lot of your clients actually relate to that, because, certainly, you know, as you go through these 2 week sprints and you put out these kind of these almost mini MVPs in the form of, you know, a candidate pool or a particular candidate, get feedback on that, improve on that. I think it's so unique. I haven't heard of that before. And I think it's super exciting. Definitely agree with you that it's definitely a trend worth kind of investing further.
Yeah.
Super exciting. You mentioned briefly a little bit about culture. And as we talk about culture of innovation is a topic that, you know, excite me the most. And recently I held an executive webinar with two panelists. It was the CTO of IBM and the CTO of SAIC. And the theme of that was building and fostering culture of innovation. And from there are a lot of interesting takeaways from that conversation. And I'm curious to get your take on that. As you guys encounter a particular problem or a particular situation that requires you for your entire organization to come together and come up with innovative way to solve a particular problem, what strategies or initiatives do you have in place that really help you and your organization come up with innovative ways to solve problems and actually help your clients, you know, be better, be, you know, optimize their processes and so forth?
Sure. So I guess the way I'll answer that, I mean, you know, we're a small firm, we're growing, but for us, innovation is, we just meet a lot, we talk a lot, you know, we have a process whereby, you know, we use a software program where if somebody has an innovative idea, they put it into the program, and then my senior leadership team reviews each of those ideas, and then we create a process to either put them into production or reject them if we don't think that it's a viable idea. But I think where I'd like to focus my response to this question is more in the way that I see innovation happening in our client organizations and some of the challenges. So for a long time, CIO said, okay, we need to innovate. We need innovation as a capability here. Let's build an innovation center. This innovation center is going to go off and they're going to do like an innovation center of excellence, and they're going to partner with universities, and they're going to pilot cool things with artificial intelligence or whatever, and they're going to create all these innovative ideas. But the problem was, if innovation is happening over here in a vacuum, how do you put it into production? How do you go take that innovation and now put it into production in a way that doesn't, you know, confuse people and overwhelm people? Plus, the implication there is that innovation is some function that happens over here, when really innovation should be part of the culture, mm-hmm, and part of what we're all doing, right? It shouldn't be just some, you know, you don't have an organization that's just called success, right? And you have success over there. No, you know, success should be a part of the culture. So what companies started to do is, and then you also have companies hiring chief innovation officers. Well, what's that job? Does it have resources? And you know, again, if you have just a function called innovation, how does the innovation really make its way through a company's culture and operations? So to my mind, the most effective thing that big Fortune 500 companies are doing on innovation is they're creating cross-functional nimble teams, often called product teams. And what they're saying to that team, which has marketing and R&D and IT and maybe operations, customer service, right? A nice cross-functional group of people, which is already breaking down silos, which we want. And instead of them saying, you know, saying to that team, build us a new capability to convert online users to buyers, build that tool. Instead, they say, we have a metric we're trying to improve. We're trying to improve web conversions, and we need some innovative thinking around how to do it. Go. And you let that product team not deliver a technology that you've told them to deliver, but tackle a problem together. That process in itself is innovative. And that's how, once you get a cross-functional group all working together, then that innovation through that leadership goes into each one of those departments. So to my mind, the key to innovation out there, or one key, is not to have some group responsible for innovation, but to have little cross-functional groups all solving problems together. That is where you're going to get your innovation from. And innovation without a smooth ride into production isn't worth it. Mm-hmm. So those cross, you know, you call it agile development, you could call it product management mindset, but it's those little cross-functional nimble teams. That to me is a best practice in creating an innovative.
Right. I love those recommendations. And I've been in organizations where they've had this so-called innovation council or innovation hub, so to say. And I've never seen any successful, you know, use case or case study that came out of that, where they actually, that little innovation hub came up with some transformational or really cool products and services, more, you know, within the lines of having the smaller teams, product related groups that are able to treat, you know, innovation and almost experimentation to the extent to have the, you know, the power and the autonomy to look at different problems and come up with solutions for that. That really what fosters and builds the overarching kind of culture of innovation.
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
Martha, one of the very highly requested topics on the Ivy podcast is around women in leadership, female executives in tech. And as you work with different types of executives and CIOs and CTOs, I know it's a very loaded question that comes your way, that we could probably spend an entire podcast episode just on that. But if you were to highlight a few points for some of our listeners who are early stage, mid-stage career professionals, you know, mostly females, and as they move up in their ranks, as they choose a career path and growth in technology and executive leadership, what recommendations, or what are current recommendations that you provide to some of your mentees or some of the potential candidates that, you know, that you could share with us?
Sure. So I'll just tell you a quick story on this. You mentioned Harvard. I was a long, long time ago at a women CIOs roundtable hosted by the CIO of Harvard Business School, who was a woman, mm-hmm. and she had a bunch of female CIOs there. And I went and participated. And somebody asked, what's been a key to your success as a female CIO? And all of them echoed the same point. Having a partner responsible for the children and the domestic life. So I thought, stay at home dad, I gotta get one of those. So I did. So my wonderful husband, who has a wonderful career as a librarian, took a lot of time off to help raise, you know, to take the lion's share of raising our children, which meant that if a client called and I needed to get to New York fast, I could just get up and do it. I didn't have to worry about negotiating, and I didn't have to, you know, have my heartstrings tugged while I'm going on my business trip because I've abandoned my children in some way. So I guess what I would say to up and comers is understand that when you have a family, if the partnership in raising those children and having that family is not either very equally distributed or in fact where the lion's share falls on your partner, it's going to be harder for you. So that's just one thing to think about. I mean, you look at right now, everything you read about all these children who are online now, and they need help, right? They need help connecting. I mean, you got a a 6-year-old kid, send them to school. Here, they need help with things all day long. Well, all the statistics and all the data is showing that it's the women who are taking the brunt there. The women who have careers, suddenly now they're being a stay-at-home moms while also having a career. So I would say just to understand that's a dynamic that exists. And as you're thinking through, when are you going to have kids? And when are you going to get married? And who are you going to marry? And what about your career? Those things all have to work together. That's number one. Mm-hmm. The second thing I would say is where we are with COVID, I've heard a really interesting dynamic, which is that in big meetings, when we're all in a room together, often it's the loudest voice that's going to get heard. It's the most aggressive voice that's going to get heard. Sometimes that aggressive voice is not a female voice. Sometimes you can find female voices a little subdued. They're not the ones pounding. Sometimes in, you know, certain cultures, it's not until the man says the idea that it's going to get picked up anyway, right? We have an opportunity here because we're all Zoom now or whatever we're using for video collaboration. And that means that when you speak, your thumbnail gets bigger, everybody mutes, and now you've got the mic. It is a more egalitarian venue
right
now than we've ever had. Use that opportunity. If you're doing a Zoom with 8 other people and you're the only female voice, it's easier on Zoom to claim that microphone than it is necessarily in a big in-person meeting. Use that opportunity. Don't waste that opportunity or squander it. That's one. The other thing is there are so many women in IT mentoring groups right now, right? You know, CIOs, female CIOs of large companies who felt that they've had a great career are very actively mentoring up and comers. And given again, where we are with COVID, you don't have to bake in an extra trip to go to a conference to be a part of a female mentoring program. You can do that digitally. Mm-hmm. So how, without getting too political here, there is an old boys club. The old boys club has been alive and well for a really, really long time. And it's kind of subtle, right? It might be, maybe you and I together, make a joke about, our wives being the ball and chain. Seems kind of innocuous and fine, but it's actually an old boys club. And so women need to create that women's club. It doesn't mean you don't have mentors who are men and, all of that. But I would say, if I'm a young woman starting out, these are things I would want to understand. One, work-family balance, you got to bake that into your planning. Two, take advantage of every opportunity to have the microphone, use your voice. Three, be a real contributing member of a women and IT networking opportunity. And the last thing, John, is every company wants to hire women in technology right now. Women, everybody says diversity, what they mean is women for the most part. Everybody wants to hire. Women are now 18% of IT leadership. 18%. Wow. You, up-and-comer female, are a very rarefied and high-demand population. Now, today is your day. So I think it's a very exciting time to be a woman in technology.
Right. I love the summary, and I love those points in terms of, the work-life balance and actually leveraging the current times as an opportunity to let your voice be heard. You gave a really, really good example in terms of, everyone's on Zoom these days.
That's
and
right.
it's such a perfect opportunity to let your voice be heard. You use that as to your advantage. Excellent. I love those recommendations, Marta. Thanks so much. And in closure of our, you know, very short conversation, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about some books.
Okay.
And I don't want our listeners to think that this is a promotional episode about Martha's book. None whatsoever. I personally was inspired by your book, and I've read it, and I recommend to a lot of my peers. I gave it to my boss, and he loved it too.
Thank you.
So I want to hear it from, you know, directly from, you know, from the author.
Yes.
What's kind of if you were to highlight some of the key takeaways from the book that you want those who have not read it, what would that be? If you could share with us some of the key takeaways.
I mean, I think the first is to understand that as a CIO, you must be a business leader first and a technologist second. But boy, when you switch on that technologist hat, you've got to be really sharp on technology. So, I mean, the takeaways are really, there are a number of different ways to be the business. One is understanding the business, having that business acumen. Maybe it's having an MBA. Maybe it's leading in a function other than IT. That's one. And that's really about you and your own personal and professional growth.
Right.
The second is you want to embed IT people into the business. That's creating a structure of business relationship management people. So maybe one person who's got one foot in IT, they've got one foot in sales and marketing. They've got one foot in IT, they've got one foot in finance and HR. So embedding your IT people into the business is a second way. A third way is importing business people into IT. So if you need somebody to head up IT for your commercial operations, what if you brought in a commercial leader and you know, to create again that melding of the business and IT? And the last piece is even more profoundly structural. And I'll just say it this way, okay? Before this country was even formed, we were a bunch of farmers, and it was an agrarian economy for hundreds of years. Then early 19th century, we became an industrial economy, and we had CFOs and boards of directors and shareholders, right? And we had moats around our businesses because we didn't want our competitors to get our secrets. And we had walls around our departments because we wanted everybody to be very specialized. But we're not in the industrial economy anymore. We're in the digital economy, or maybe even the data economy, where everything is different. I mean, in my opinion, we saw a data economy almost topple our democracy in a way that we've never imagined. Because once you've got data and Facebook and everybody can be on in their own little media echo chamber, bipartisanship has an entirely different meaning to it. That's because we're in a data economy. You know, when was our democracy built? In an agrarian / industrial economy. And here we are, a data economy, trying to use the exact same structures.
Right.
Well, that's true of an organization as well, and boards of directors and hierarchy and, you know, silos and individual budgets.
Mm-hmm.
If we're gonna be successful as companies in a data economy, we gotta dismantle all of that. We can't have one department responsible for technology.
Right.
But we're a technology company now. We used to be retail, we used to be insurance, we used to be automotive, but we're technology now. How do you just leave technology in one department?
Right.
We need to democratize technology and make sure that there's technology leadership in each one of these different departments. That's a very different way of thinking.
Right.
To me, that's the most important point to come out of the book is we can't operate our companies as though the digital economy didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Actually, feels very unique to read the book first and then hear the author's perspective. It's very interesting. Very interesting dynamic. So thank you for summarizing that. And Martha, last but not least, what are you currently reading? And what is one book that you always recommend to others that is not yours?
Sure. So, you know, what I'm reading now is, you know, several years ago, my husband got me a book about art in New York City, and I suddenly was hooked. Uh-huh. And all I want to read about now is art and art history. I've just become, you know, when I retire, I want to go just take art history classes and be on the board of an art museum. It's just art has overtaken my life. So what I'm reading right now is something by Giorgio Vasari called The Lives of the Artists that he wrote in the 15th century. So wow. This is a Renaissance writer. And what he did was he put all the artists, Michelangelo, Giotto, all of the Raphael, he gave them celebrity for the first time back in the Renaissance. You know, now we know all these famous artists. He was responsible for creating that notion of a celebrity artist. So, and it's just fun stories about, you know, all the famous artists. So I'm enjoying that. But in terms of a business book that I recommend to others, because, you know, I recommend fiction, all sorts of things. It depends on who I'm recommending to. Right. But there's a business book that my old boss from ZRG gave me. This is very old. It's called Blue Ocean Strategy. You see that?
Yep.
This book is basically about the way, if you're in a market, it becomes a red sea because there's a bunch of sharks, and sorry to be so graphic, but they're all kind of going after the same meat, right? So you get this red, bloody sea. But the shark that swims over into that big, beautiful blue ocean before the other sharks have shown up, that's the winning strategy. So classic example, Starbucks. You know, nobody paid $8 for a cup of coffee before Starbucks came along. Amazon found their blue ocean in retail, but now they found a blue ocean in cloud. That blows my mind that Amazon captured the retail market, and now they're capturing a corporate IT market too. That's blue ocean. So here at Heller Search, we're one P&L. Most search firms are lots of little P&Ls. Our go-to-market strategy is thought leadership, content, and writing. Can't find another search firm that does that.
Yeah.
Our Heller report that goes out to 25,000 of our readers, all IT execs, and it's a two-way street. They send us things, we send them things. That relationship with our brand, that's all unique. That's all blue ocean. You know, the book, the concept alone, I really like, but then there's exercises of how do you actually turn your business in, get your business out of the Red Sea and into the blue ocean. And I just enjoyed that as a book, but it's really worked for us in terms of our go-to-market strategy at Heller Search.
I love that. I've heard about it, haven't read it. And for our listeners who are listening, not looking at the video, Martha is actually showing the book in itself, Blue Ocean, and we'll make the title and the author of these books available in the episode notes for you guys. And, you know, just in closure, something that, you know, you've mentioned initially and you closed out with that, really the brand of whether your personal brand or the organization, it's that resonates so well with me because the current organization that I'm part with, the ProSource IT, is similar in, you know, in general industry perspective, what you guys do, but we operate in very niche IT staffing space where we hire, you know, the cloud engineers, the site reliability engineers, stuff like that. And a lot of the lessons learned that, you know, through this very short conversation, also kind of something that I'm very passionate about, is we're not only just helping the companies, you know, find these candidates, but at the end of the day is really establishing yourself as the thought leader, as, you know, the expert in this industry that really help you cultivate and build these meaningful relationships with potential candidates and clients and so forth. You know, in my book, that's, you know, an ultimate ingredient for success in, you know, in anything that you do. So, Martha, I really appreciate your insights, your time today. I know it was a very short conversation, but at least for me, it was very informative. I learned quite a bit. Looking forward to staying in touch with you, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, John. I'll just say, you know, way back in 1999, I did a radio series for CIO Magazine called CIO Radio, where I would interview people. And so I really enjoyed this because it takes me way back, right, to when I used to do that, but you do a much better job than I do. So I really appreciate the time and enjoyed this quite a bit. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Martha. 99, that's actually when I first came to the U.S.
That? I got a couple of years of you, John. I know.
Awesome. Martha, thanks so much. We'll be in touch.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.